Happy New Year, everyone. And I'm aware that, coming down here, that it's been 1 year now since we've been here. And it was a year ago, the first Sunday of last January, that we came down here and had our first formal Sunday sitting, and I gave my first Dharma talk. So it's been a wonderful year, this last year. And I thought, both because of was what we talked about last year, and also because it seems like a nice thing to talk about at the beginning of a year, and maybe always talk about it, is to talk a little bit about the Four Noble Truths, which was a topic for last January. And in thinking about this very important theme in Buddhism, I'm reminded that all of the Buddha's teachings can or could be summed up in the very simple expression that if you cling, you'll suffer. And if you don't cling, the suffering will go away. And the word for suffering is dukkha. And it's translated many different ways into English by different translators. And the one I saw recently was discontent. So if you have discontent, if you cling, you'll have discontent of some sort. Unease is another one. If you cling, you'll have unease. You'll be uneasy. If you cling, you'll feel unsatisfactoriness. Things are unsatisfactory in some way. If you cling, you'll have misery. If you cling, you'll have grief, sorrow, and lamentation. And it's interesting to word it that way, to say if you cling, then you'll have suffering, as opposed to saying if you suffer, then that's because of your clinging. Wherever there's clinging, there'll be suffering, or some sort of other. And all of you have your own special varieties that your favorite types. And clinging, then also there's many different ways of translating the word clinging. The word is tanna. And tanna literally means thirst, which has a very kind of, you know, physical feeling to it. You know, being thirsty, kind of just drive. You know, if you're really thirsty, you know, you really want, you're desperate, you're kind of, there's a fixation perhaps on taking care of that. And so there can be this mental thirst, this clinging or craving, a sense of drivenness, a sense of compulsion. So if you're compulsive, you'll suffer. If you're driven, you'll suffer. If you crave, you'll suffer. If you, then there's a converse thing, the craving. If you resist, you'll suffer. If you hate, you'll suffer. So if you cling a lot, you'll suffer a lot. If your clinging is great, your suffering will be great. And if your clinging is small, your suffering will be small. So, that's it. Now, apply it to your life. As you wish. And so, although the Buddha's teachings can be subsumed, in a sense, under these two categories, to focus on suffering, and to focus on the release from suffering. And I read recently an article by a psychotherapist who argued that in American culture, the value of suffering is undervalued. That he thinks that suffering is actually very important when you suffer, in the sense that if you avoid it at all costs, if you try to recoil from it and escape from it, you're not likely to do the work of understanding your suffering deeply, and really seeing it for what it is. And so he, being a psychotherapist, he talked about the tremendous emphasis now on medication in the world of psychotherapy, which has kind of skyrocketed in the last 15 years, and argued, at least he argued, that sometimes people have the false assumptions that there's a cure for a mental suffering. And if you have that medicine, if you have that pill, you've gotten the cure. And he said that's kind of, sometimes certainly the medication is very helpful, but it's not the cure. And more often than not, he says, that there is some kind of something deep below the suffering that sometimes we can attend to and learn from. And the Buddha would say that your suffering has as its root some kind of clinging. And if your attitude towards suffering is, I don't want to get close to it, I don't want to pay attention to it, give me a spiritual practice that takes me away from it, that gives me bliss and joy, then it can be a kind of myopic spiritual life or an unwise life, because the forces, the root of clinging, the tendency to that is unattended to. So it's fascinating, at this last retreat, there was a lovely woman there who had spent over 2 decades in a spiritual tradition. She actually became a teacher in the tradition, that where one of the teachings was, people don't have enough joy. So what we need to do is to focus on meditations that bring a lot of joy. And she had developed tremendous capacity to sit in meditation and bliss out. She can go into this great happy states and great light and kind of dissolving the body, and just, it was really great. She was really good at it. She was so happy to be at the retreat, because she said, I'm finally ready to face life as it actually is. And to really see, you know, not to escape into that place of joy, but to really see the places of clinging, of holding, to really see where the discomfort is, to see the way in which I've recoiled from really being there for the suffering of the world and seeing it for what it is. So here's a woman who really found value, as this psychotherapist talked about, somehow stopping and being present for our suffering. And that's the injunction, or the encouragement, in the First Noble Truth, which is study your suffering, get to know it, realize what it is. And it's not meant to be kind of heavy and dark or morbid or depressing. The beautiful thing, I believe, for many people who really take on the Four Noble Truths is that they become better and better at recognizing suffering, but they get lighter and lighter about it as they get better. Kind of lighter and happier. And it's, you know, that's so. Because as we study our suffering, get to see it, then we start seeing the root causes of it. We start seeing the clinging, the craving, the thirsting that goes on. And one form of craving or thirsting or resistance is our very judgment about suffering being there in the first place. So if we're getting heavy about our suffering, if we're getting oppressed by it, that itself is another form of suffering that the Four Noble Truths is supposed to clarify and free us from. Isn't that great? So the whole thing, the whole system is a self-correcting system where you actually get lighter and lighter the more you study your suffering. Make sense? That's an important point. Otherwise, it's kind of dour. And so I told my son, I was in Safeway the other day with my son, my 4-year-old son, and he started his thing about wanting. And I don't think it really works to tell him, you know, the more you want, the more you'll suffer. But there he was, wanting, and all we needed to do was get milk. So it was like, you know, let's go to the milk place and get the milk and leave. Because Safeway is not a kind of place that you normally would choose to stay in. But but there we were. And there's been a pattern of having this wanting. So I told him, I'll tell you a story. You like to hear a story about a little troll? He kind of looked at me. It's an odd place to tell a story. It's the aisles of Safeway. Okay. And this is a little wanting troll. It's a teeny little wanting troll. There was a little boy who came along. And who should the boy be? And he said, not, my son's name is Torin. Not Torin. Often he likes to be part of the stories. I think he caught on. And so I said, he was, you know, he was outside the store, and this boy came to the store. This little wanting trill jumped in his mouth. And when the boy got into the store, he just kept wanting things everywhere, wanting. And finally, his mother realized what had happened and went in there and pulled out that little wanting troll. And then the boy was much happier. And I had the very strong impression that he did not appreciate the story. Maybe in 20 years I'll tell him the story again. Maybe then. So the willingness to stop for our suffering, the willingness to look at it and be with it, and not to, and to do it, to realize, willing to stop for it because you realize the value of stopping for it. If you don't see the value of stopping for your suffering, maybe it's not so helpful, I don't know. But if you really see the value of stopping for it and looking at it, and one of the values is a secondary value in that, what is the relationship we have to our suffering? Do we suffer more because we suffer? And many of us do. We judge the suffering, you know, oh, this is embarrassing that I'm suffering, or this is terrible I'm suffering, or I hate it, I need to hold it at a distance, I need to shut down, I need to do something. We do something in relationship to our suffering. And if we realize how important it can be to stop for the suffering so we can kind of see what is our secondary relationship we have to it, what's the relationship we have to it, and clarify that, it won't make our suffering go away, but it'll make it a lot easier to suffer. And there are sometimes people come to me to talk to me about their suffering, and sometimes it can be very severe, sometimes it's very difficult, sometimes people are very depressed or something. And it's not always clear to me that I know what to say to them, what's helpful, in terms of helping them with their primary problem. But what I then will focus on with them is what is their relationship to that primary problem? And often enough, the relationship they have to it is really important. And if they can clarify that, then they're not going to become happily depressed. But but they're going to be much more ease about it. So they're not, you know, so troubled by it. Grief is another one. You know, there's a lot of complications we have towards grief. We have deep grief that are extra, that are complications. So what is the relationship we have to it? So that's part of the value of stopping for suffering. Another value is then we can kind of begin kind of looking behind the suffering and seeing how it works, what's really going on. What kind of suffering is it? Are we suffering because we don't want things to be the way they are? Are we suffering because we want things to be the way they are, but they're changing? What are we clinging to? What are we holding on to? So then the second noble truth, the word noble is interesting. There's one scholar that I like a lot. It translates the word as the ennobling truths. And I like that a lot because the whole function of the Four Noble Truths, they're not like the truths, you know, the great truths, They're those truths which help in the process of becoming free. Those truths which are helpful for becoming ennobled, attaining that dignity of being someone who is become liberated or free, become released from their clinging and holding. So they have a function, the Four Noble Truths. And by translating by the word ennobling, it points to the function they have to ennoble us. So so the ennobling truth of suffering. So to just simply say that, you know, there's suffering, you know, some people will get kind of, oh, those Buddhists. But if you say the ennobling truth of suffering, oh, there's something there. What is that? So then there's the ennobling truth of the cause of suffering, which is a second noble truth. And it's very simply said to be thirst, tanha, craving. But then the Buddha talks a lot about what is it we cling to, what's a form of clinging and craving. One of the very common forms of clinging is clinging to pleasure, to comfort, to ease, to clinging to sensual delight. And many people who have addiction problems are often confusing pleasure with happiness. And so they're pursuing this kind of addiction, which is another word for tanha, for this thirst. And so this, you know, attachment to pleasure. Or conversely, the resistance to discomfort, which drives some people into suffering. And we see that a lot on retreats, where retreats are not always comfortable. So what do? When it's not uncomfortable, well, you can go to, you can leave the retreat. You can start. Some people fantasize about going to Tahiti. You know, anything to get away. Or some people get angry and frustrated and take it out on themselves or take it out on others. But there's an ennobling way of connecting to suffering, an ennobling way of connecting to our aversion, our resistance. To really see it, to be with it. There's also the clinging or craving to what's called becoming. And becoming is includes things like ego enhancement, you know, being... John Travis gave a beautiful talk last week on partly on the suffering around being self-importance and being special. Some important, you know, I'm really special, and you better notice how special I am, how important I am. And then there's the opposite suffering of not wanting to be seen, not wanting to be special, wanting to be invisible, and clinging to that. One of my, you know, for example, for me a little bit. Is not so much anymore, but still I think I suffer from this, is I don't like to wear T-shirts that have anything on them because I don't want to be anybody. you know, I don't want to present myself some way. And my son loves to wear T-shirts with something on it because he really wants to, he finds it happy and joyful. And, you know, so I'm a little bit attached to unbecoming, to not becoming, to non-existence a little bit. And, you know, so we cling to ideas of who we think we need to be, and we suffer. We cling to ideas of who we shouldn't be, and we suffer. And this plays itself out in all kinds of situations where we have an ideal we're trying to measure ourselves against. We have something that happens inside of us that we feel is wrong. And then it's all too common to set, have a war within us between that part of us which we don't like and that part of us we think is supposed to be happening. And we certainly see that a lot in meditation where someone thinks, oh, I'm supposed to be in peace but really I'm agitated. Or I'm supposed to be with my breath and really I'm restless. And so there's this tension that gets created between what's really going on and the ideal of staying with the breath or staying calm or whatever. And it can be kind of fighting ourselves. And I see it over and over again, people fighting with aspects of themselves. This is not good, this is not right, I have to get away from it, I have to stop it, I have to crush it, I have to destroy it. And part of the beauty of mindfulness is we don't fight ourselves, but we turn the attention around and bring our attention to that which we're fighting, that which we are opposed to. And then can we have an ennobling presence towards that which we find difficult within us? And perhaps by doing that, letting the difficulty of it disappear. A story I love is from a friend of mine some years ago who told me that he had a dream of holding a poisonous snake by the neck so it couldn't bite him. But it was, you know, a dream. It was a, you know, fatal, you know, lethal snake. But he wanted to let go of the snake. But, you know, if you let go of it, the neck would be free enough to swing around and bite him. So he didn't know what to do. He was going around holding it and wanted to let go of it. And finally, he did let go of it in the dream. And when he let go of it, the snake vanished. So, letting go. What are we holding on to? What are we clinging to? And why are we clinging? What's the value that clinging has for us? And that often has something to do with safety and security, often with a sense of self, often with our ideals that we cling to, what we think we need to have in our life. And you can see the lawyers of the mind coming into play around when you come up against the edge of the possibility of letting go of some clinging, something we're holding on to. Oh, I need to cling because I need to cling. That's how I get what I need in life. That's how I'll protect myself. That's how... Or what's wrong with some clinging? You know, it's good all clinging. You know, it gives me good energy and vitality. And, you know, it's great to have that vitality and sense of aliveness when I have a really good clinging bout. And so there's all these reasons that come into play. And so it's interesting to look at that. You know, what are the arguments you have for why you can't let go of clinging? The Buddha said, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. What do you say? And then, but not to say that you're wrong, but I would encourage you to have that discussion with the Buddha. You know, really explore, why is it that you think clinging is worthwhile, if you do? It's common enough. And one of the interesting things about clinging in all its forms, it can have a kind of self-fulfilling, is that the right word? Self-propelling quality, where clinging evokes more clinging. Or clinging helps us become blind to the suffering of itself. For example, you're clinging, you really want some beautiful object, some nice thing. It's pleasant, you have wonderful, nice fantasies about it. And so we're seduced by the pleasantness of the object of clinging that we don't really feel the cost of the clinging, the suffering in the clinging. The clinging is often outwardly directed. The resistance is sometimes outwardly directed in a sense away from awareness itself. And so because we're so fixated on the object, what we're paying attention to, we don't notice the cost of clinging or resisting itself. And one of the reasons why I think we can say with some confidence, if you cling, you will suffer, is because clinging in and of itself is painful, is a form of suffering. And it'll produce more suffering, tends to produce more suffering down the line. And then there's clinging to unbecoming, which is the technical term, not becoming, which is wanting things to be different, wanting things to go away, pushing things away, wanting not to exist. So it's fascinating that both the clinging to existence and clinging to non-existence is a form of suffering that drains our energy, drains our vitality ultimately. The third ennobling truth is that if you stop clinging, you'll stop suffering. So there's first is suffering, the cause of suffering, and then suffering will end when you stop clinging. And it's that simple. And if you let go a little bit, Ajahn Chah said, if you let go a little bit, you have a little bit of happiness or peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace or happiness. What's the opposite of suffering? Non-suffering. So, what else? What's the opposite of suffering?
Acceptance.
At ease.
Peace.
Sorry?
Openness.
Serenity.
Freedom.
Joy.
Contentment.
Emptiness.
Surrender.
Release.
Non-resistance.
Fluidity. Sounds good to me. So the expression, you know, that the very simple thing that if you let go of your clinging, you won't suffer, The ending of clinging is the ending of suffering. Sounds like a pretty simple statement, but as the answers you gave, it actually opens up to a really wonderful depth and really wonderful dimension of human life. And the tendency is not to define it in positive terms, even though, like many of you had positive terms for it, because then the tendency is for people to cling to that. And either if they don't have it, to cling to it or measure themselves against it and say, I'm not good enough because I don't have that serenity or whatever. Or if they have some experience of calm or peace or something, it's very common for people to cling to that, hold on to that in some way. Hold on to it when it's there and become brittle, or hold on to it when it's gone away by holding on to the memory or whatever, all kinds of things in relationship to it. And the ennobling truths, in that being a process of continual reflection, is to always be looking at where is the clinging and where is the release from it. And not to settle at any particular state as being, aha, this is it. But always be willing to do this reflection over and over again. But the experience of release from clinging, I feel, is one of the most sublime and beautiful things that a human being can experience. And small release maybe doesn't feel that sublime or wonderful. But when you start realizing how pervasive clinging functions in our lives, and you get a sense of when the pervasiveness of it, the subtlety of it begins to fall away, it's really one of the most amazing things. The most amazing thing, perhaps. And one of the ways to get the sense of how pervasive clinging is to meditate and watch your thoughts and see if you can control your thinking. See if you can stop thinking. And most of the compulsion to think comes with a form of clinging. There can be thinking without clinging. But if you can't let go of your thinking and rest peacefully because you're pulled back into your thoughts or you're kind of pulled off into thinking about something, obsessed, fixated on it, then there's clinging. And often as we go through our daily life, we're not so subtly sensitive to the train, the flow of our thoughts, to see how even our thoughts are being propelled or directed or held in place, fueled along by a little bit of holding on to them, fixating on them. A little thirsting there that's going on. What is it like when thinking itself is not characterized by any kind of clinging? So that maybe is trying to give you an indication of how subtle it can be. It's not just simply not, you know, no longer clinging to what? You know, something large and obvious. So then there's the last of the Four Noble Truths, the ennobling truth of the Eightfold Path. And I like to think of this as this way, that the first three statements are very simple. A child could understand them. Maybe. suffering, cause of suffering, and the ending of suffering. But even though they're very simple statements, it's very hard to do thoroughly, completely, to really have it penetrate all the different corners and recesses of our minds and psyche. And so the Buddha then offered a path that supports that happening, a path that lays the foundation so that the attention, our intelligence, can go as deeply as possible and to ferret out the places of holding so we can find the deepest wellsprings of peace and happiness that's possible for a human being. And so there's Eightfold Path then becomes kind of the template or the kind of general guideline for someone who, following the Buddha's path, are engaged in these things, reflecting on these things, working with these things, practicing with these. And I like to think of, in looking at the Eightfold Path, that the Buddha meant us to use all our intelligence, all our intelligences, when we engage in the path. You're not expected to kind of, you know, check out, drop or ignore some of your intelligence in order to practice, which some people seem to think they need to do. And we have many different forms of intelligences. And there's certainly cognitive intelligence, processing intelligence of logic. There's the intelligence of emotions, which Daniel Goldman talks about. And there's kinesthetic intelligence and different forms of intelligence. You're supposed to use whatever intelligence you have. You don't have to be intelligent to practice. But you all have some intelligence, right? Yeah, otherwise you wouldn't have found yourself here today. You managed to get your clothes on and get here. So everybody has some, but important thing is to use whatever you have. And use it for the purposes of becoming peaceful. For the purposes of finding where the clinging is and seeing how you can relax it, let go of it. And so then, because that's the purpose, there's then a corrective quality to using your intelligence. Because some people, for example, have a lot of cognitive intelligence. They think a lot and analyzing what's going on. And that can just keep a person disconnected and keep a person kind of, agitated and not really settled in a deep way. But if you're using that analytical intelligence in order to help you become peaceful, I think there's a self-correcting quality there. You realize its limitations. And when you realize its limitations, you'll naturally let go of it, soften it. The analogy that I like is that of using sandpaper. If the wood is really coarse, first you use coarse sandpaper. And then you've kind of gotten as far as the coarse sandpaper will go, you get a little bit finer sandpaper, and you get the wood even smoother. But then that makes a little bit of lines. And then you do a finer one, until finally you're just using a little piece of cloth. So the same thing with ourselves, that we need to use, the coarsest intelligences that we have initially at certain points. But then we also have to have the wisdom to know when to let go of it and use something more refined and finer and finer. So the first two aspects of the Eightfold Path have a lot to do with using your thoughts and thinking, that part of your intelligence. And the first one is having what's called the right view. But that also seems kind of strange to people, right view. There's a right and wrong view, and those Buddhists think they know it. And whatever, it's like, feels like, some creed. But remembering, it's the right view for the purposes of ennobling ourselves. For the purpose of setting ourselves free. So what is the viewpoint that helps us set us free? And the viewpoint that the Buddha said helps set us free is to begin understanding our life from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths. To actually take an interest in suffering, taking an interest in what's the cause of that suffering, taking an interest in letting go of it, that cause. It's not easy to really understand where the clinging is, always. Sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes it's very hard to understand where the clinging is. You know you're suffering, you kind of look at it and look at it and look, and you can't really see, what am I clinging to? It's really hard. But you have to be interested in the exercise. So have the viewpoint, take on the view, or take on the perspective, I'm going to study this and get to know it. The second one is to have rightly directed thinking. To have your thoughts or your intentions directed in a certain direction that's helpful. So it is a kind of channeling and choosing what you're going to be thinking about. And so, for example, if it's not very helpful to be day and night thinking about the stock market, I don't think that's helped too many people become free. Or, you know, there's all kinds of trains of thought, directions of the mind that takes, that aren't that conducive to helping us become free. So can you choose to let your mind go in useful directions? And there's a number of ones the Buddha gave, and I don't remember the whole list right now. I don't know if maybe someone here remembers the list. But one of them, I think it was thoughts of relinquishment, thoughts of letting go, thoughts of renunciation. To have your thoughts in the direction of, what can I let go of? You know, to have that in your mind. Not to be, you know, an ascetic about it, not because you need to kind of do it blindly or because it's good to be, you know, not have things. But what is it that you can let go of that helps you become simpler enough that you can begin looking deeply? If you're always thinking about the stock market, maybe you need to relinquish that concern, at least for a couple of hours a day, you know, or so you can kind of focus your attention to look deeply, to sit and meditate, for example. So to have thoughts about what can you let go of? What can you simplify? Both internally, maybe externally. It's one of the things the Buddha encouraged. The other is thoughts of loving kindness. Thoughts of love. To have the direction of your mind be in the direction of love or kindness. Kindness towards yourself, kindness to the people around you, the world around you. So to choose that as a direction for the thinking mind to take. And then there's a third one. I don't remember what it is. So that's kind of using your thinking capacity, the first two. The next three have to do with your actions, what you do in the world, your behavior. And it requires a lot of discernment. Having right action, your ethics, your behavior, to live a virtuous life. It's very hard to have the sensitivity to go deep in and study our clinging if you're living an insensitive life. And to intentionally be transgressing the precepts, to be killing people or other beings, to be stealing, to be lying, to be harming other people through your sexuality, to harming yourself by getting intoxicated. It's very hard, if you do those things, to develop the deep sensitivity it requires to sense and feel our way into the deepest clinging we have. So if you want to follow the ennobling path, you would then look at these, you know, the precepts and live by those precepts. Right speech. Very helpful. If all you did for a week or for a year, for, you know, whatever, is completely track why you say what you say, it would open up deep, deep insights into what makes you tick, what makes you work, what you cling to. Why do you say what you say? And the Buddha encouraged us to speak with sensitivity. So with kindness, don't be harsh in your speech, don't lie, don't gossip, things like that. Then there's a right livelihood. To have a livelihood, since many of us spend much of our days working, to have a work or have a source of livelihood that is in harmony with the ennobling path. So again, you look at it from the point of view of sensitivity. Don't do kind of activities that you have to be somewhat insensitive to the suffering in the world in doing those activities. And the Buddha gave a particular list, but that's for you to figure out what list works for you. But the Buddha was very clear that do not be engaged in trading of weapons. Anything having to do with weapons, don't be involved in that kind of work. Don't be involved in the trade of alcohol, drugs, and poisons. I think poisons back in the old days meant, you know, poisons for people. And kind of like a weapon. And don't be involved in professions that involve killing. So being a butcher is considered a no-no in Buddhism. And so kind of odd thing is that Buddhists in many countries in Asia would still eat meat, but it would be the, for example, in Thailand, it would be the Muslims who would be the butchers. That way, they wouldn't have the karma of killing. And the last three of the Eightfold Path have to do with beginning to cultivate the mind. Cultivating the right effort, making the effort in the mind to, in a healthy way, choose those qualities of the mind which are helpful, skillful for the purposes of liberation. And learning how to let go of those qualities of the mind which are not skillful and helpful. Making that effort that it takes. So it means really tracking our mind well. Next, there's right mindfulness, to practice mindfulness, to really be mindful of what's going on in the present moment. It's a whole skill in itself, the skill to develop mindfulness. And the last is to develop our concentration, to develop our ability to be stable and composed in the midst of what our experience is. If you're not composed in your experience, it's very hard to track what's actually going on. Also, one of the nice things about concentration practice, meditation practice, is that the Buddha said that concentration practice is best built on happiness. It's easiest to get concentrated if you're happy. Now, how do you get happy? You know, as if you can just do that automatically. But I think of part of the Buddhist path is to try to find ways to encourage ourselves to be happy. At the same time as we're being encouraged to focus on our suffering, you're also encouraged to find how to be happy. And what does it take to let happiness become a more part of your life? Can it? And I think for a lot of people here in our busy society, that happiness is not always so far away if we just weren't such workaholics. Just stop, you know, and spend a little bit of time looking, you know, at the sun or the sunset or, you know, going for a walk on the Baylands or having tea with a friend or tea alone or sometimes. Are there ways to enhance our happiness and our well-being in our lives? What would it take? Looking at our intelligence as a foundation to help our mind rest, get composed, be still. Not be agitated. Because as the mind becomes more composed and still, that is the key to being able to look in the really deep depths of our psyche at the most tenacious clingings that we carry with us all the time. And that's really the ultimate function of Buddhism, is to get down to the very root clinging that holds the whole edifice of suffering in place. And have it release. So I hope that as you go through this next year, that you always remember the Four Ennobling Truths and the Eightfold Path, and that you find some way to or many ways to contemplate this very simple statement: if you cling, you'll suffer. If you let go of your clinging, your suffering will stop. Good luck.